Welcome to Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Ashkan Kazarian, Tech Freedom's Legal and Research Fellow, and your new host. If you haven't figured it out yet, Evan Schwarztrauber, Tech Freedom's original host, has left us to become a public servant, and in the best Russian fashion, I've annexed the show. To cement my rightful place, I've invited Jared Meyer, the most frequent guest of the show, to join us for his 22nd appearance. Jared, thank you for being here.
It's weird not seeing Evan, but I mean, you had to fire him sooner or later, so I don't blame Tech Freedom.
So Jared, what are you talking about today? Have you not run out of any knowledge?
I don't know, working on a lot of the same stuff, a lot of trying to get government out of the way of people who are looking for jobs and those who are trying to create jobs, working on the state level quite a bit, but still involved in some federal future work things, which is, I'm pretty sure, what we're talking about today.
So what is this new policy that the Department of Labor has taken on?
So this is interesting. It's a move that flew a little bit under the table, like a lot of what the Trump administration has done. His Secretary of Labor, Acosta, he rescinded an administrator's interpretation from President Obama's wage and hour division at the Department of Labor. And this all sounds really boring, but I wrote an article saying that, you know, Secretary Acosta saved the sharing economy. And I really don't think that's an overstatement, because what drives all the movement we've seen in the sharing economy and just independent work in general is working as an independent contractor. And that new model of work was really under threat from President Obama's administration.
So what exactly was this interpretation?
So the interpretation that was issued in 2015, if you work in the United States, you're either an employee or an independent contractor. And for a long time, the predominant test used to determine this is something called the common law test. And it matters on how much control your employer has over you. It's kind of a bargain. If you give up some control over your work, you get federal benefits that come with being an employee. Things like overtime pay, you have workers' compensation, minimum wage, all those different protections, they really only apply to employees. Whereas if you work as an independent contractor, you have much more flexibility, but you don't have those same protections. So as I said, this common law test was used for pretty much most employment determinations, except for what President Obama's Department of Labor did was take an economic realities test that, rather than looking at the degree of control, looks at how reliant a worker is on the company. So rather than control, it's the economic realities of how reliant you are on a company. And this has massive implications, because let's say if you're an Airbnb host, for example, and you work full time, you're renting out the home, you're help prepping it, doing all that full time, you're pretty economically dependent on Airbnb. So if this interpretation that was issued in 2015 was taken seriously, one could make an argument that all of a sudden Airbnb hosts would become employees rather than contractors.
Do you know of any examples of that interpretation being used?
So it was from Wage and Hour Division, which is under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And just some background history, back in the New Deal era, when you had the Fair Labor Standards, I see you yawning already. Hey, you're a lawyer, so you'll be interested in this. You had the Fair Labor Standards Act, the National Labor Relations Act, and the Social Security Act. But the Supreme Court back then took a very expansive view of who they thought should be an employee. So Congress had to rein them in by using that, as I said, more permissive for independent contractors, common law test. They legislated it in the Fair Labor in everything but the Fair Labor Standards Act. I don't know if they just forgot it or what they meant, but so the National Labor Relations Act had an update and the Social Security Act, but for Fair Labor Standards Act, it left the Department of Labor free to use other things like the economic realities test. And that's just what President Obama's Wage and Hour Division did.
And so now we went back on that. We reinterpreted that.
Yeah, well, the great thing, I guess, about administrators' interpretations and regulating through blog posts is that you can unregulate through blog posts. So you didn't have to go through the full regulatory process to rescind this, because it wasn't an actual regulation. It was effectively a blog post that was put on the website. All they did was remove it. You actually can't find it on the website anymore, and it's back to how it was before. And the reason all this matters is if you're an employee, things like, let's say, being able to work when you want and how you want, which is really a cornerstone of the gig economy or independent work, that would go away. Could, you know, for example, Uber's business model work if they had to schedule their drivers, if they had to pay them, let's say, overtime, if the drivers decided to work more? Like, the whole idea of this, I call it my grandfather's workforce, of where you have a boss, you punch a time card, you probably join a union. That was really built for a past era. Whereas today, we're moving more and more towards independent, flexible work because of technology.
So in your work, you say a lot that millennials desire this new model, right? Because we are the new generation and we see the work in different ways. But don't you think it's also because we're young and healthy and we don't think about all the consequences that might come with the work that we're doing? So maybe as we age, we would want more security. We would want more regulation, to protect us, to give us insurance and group bargaining and all of these things that unions and more regulated framework of labor is able to provide.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up job security because that's one of the biggest critiques I hear of when I'm pushing for this independent work model. The first thing I'll say is just that independent work is coming. The whole idea of why we even had large firms to begin with is what the Nobel Prize winning economist Ronald Coase called like the transaction cost theory of a firm. Why Tech Freedom goes out and hires, you know, 5 or 6 people to work here full time is it's too expensive to go out and find the perfect person for each job. I mean, economic theory says we should do every transaction, you know, on a one-off rather than bringing someone in full-time and hoping to find 40 hours of work for them a week. But because that was too expensive to, let's say, go out and find a new graphic designer when you wanted to redo Tech Freedom's logo or when you want to put together a nice brief and lay it out nicely, they bring in people full-time. What's happening is that is slowly going away. All the growth in work since the year 2000 has come from independent contractors. We actually had some people at the Mercatus Center. They looked at what was filed with the IRS, either W-9s, which employees file, or 1099, W-2s or 1099s, which are then filed by independent contractors. And there are actually fewer W-2s filed today. So all the growth since 2000 has come from independent work. And this is a trend that everyone from McKinsey to Deloitte to all the consulting firms see happening. We're just going to continue to see a steady uptick in independent work while the number of employees stays about flat.
So it sounds like this is not just affecting sharing economy. This employer and contractor divide, it affects markets in general and different parts of our economy?
Yeah, I mean, I almost define the sharing economy as the natural result of lower transaction costs. You're just getting a more distributed workforce. And actually, the wage and hour commissioner under President Obama, David Whale, he wrote a book where he talked about this workforce that was all broken apart rather than where everything was together. You're getting more outsourcing, you're getting more contracting. And while he complained about that and worried about it, at least he noticed that is where we are going. So really fighting against this, I think, is just fighting against lower transaction costs. And that's kind of just the definition of fighting progress. But in addition to that, I mean, working for an employer right now, I think one of the main reasons it's so attractive is because we subsidize employment by subsidizing healthcare that's provided by your employer. That was something that when they were debating the Affordable Care Act, trying to make healthcare more portable and more individualized so it's not tied to work, that was something they tried to do. If they did it, still up for debate. But I think that's what we need to do in the future is stop subsidizing healthcare that's provided to employers, or at least stop discriminating against people who work for themselves as entrepreneurs or independent contractors.
To better understand this policy change, do you mind sharing two or more or one example of how other countries approach this definition of like employer versus contractor?
What's interesting is the U.S. is actually one of the best countries with really the whole idea of employment at will, that you can just get rid of someone who's doing their job perfectly fine for no reason. You can fire them. That's something that I hadn't realized before I was researching this a few years ago is pretty unique to the U.S. But what we're seeing in other countries is the rise of so-called zero-hour contracts, especially with young workers, because it's so difficult to get rid of employees in these other countries. They've moved to almost completely a contracting model for younger workers. Because a way, you know, you could go through, and let's say if you wanted to dismantle 70 years or 80 years of employment law, you could try to get rid of all the laws. Or everyone who works as a contractor pretty much gets around everything that we have because employment is what we've used for so long to regulate the labor market. We let independent contractors almost operate outside of all these laws and regulations. I think that's a big reason why you've seen so much pushback to sharing economy firms from organized labor because they understand that people who work as independent contractors aren't able to collectively bargain. They can form a union, but they can't collectively negotiate wages. And you've seen this fight play out in Seattle, where they're now trying to allow Uber drivers and taxi drivers and Lyft drivers to organize and collectively bargain. It's really become ground zero. Like, Uber isn't a threat to unions, but the model that they use of work, of being able to work independently as a contractor, that is a fundamental threat to unions' continued existence.
So if in Seattle of unionizing collective bargaining movement wins, how do you see this affecting economy?
Well, I think you'll see a bigger discussion have to go on the federal level, because there's still questions about if it's even legal for a locality to really get around federal law by all of a sudden saying independent contractors can collectively bargain. But there's going to have to be a discussion at some point about how we're going to classify workers moving forward, because I don't see politicians being fine with saying, you know what, we're going to have half of workers now be completely outside of all labor protections. But I also worry that we're going to take the old, outdated employer-employee model and try to push it on these new work arrangements that have come about because of technology. And I should point out, just as I said, the sharing economy is much bigger than Uber and Airbnb. I mean, you have highly skilled professionals like on sites like Catalent that's pretty much for MBAs and business consulting. You have Thumbtack for very skilled professionals to come do everything from being a personal chef to a music instructor to coming and fixing your plumbing. There's endless amounts of ways that this independent work can help workers and extend to all skill levels and wage levels. What you're seeing right now is most of the media focuses on sharing economy companies because they've tended to be the most disruptive. But this whole freelancing economy is only going to continue to grow.
So anything from TaskRabbit to Etsy would count as sharing economy?
I would count it as that because it's an easier way to have to work with just a platform rather than work for an employer. So you're just utilizing a platform to be able to market your business better and reach customers better rather than having to be reliant on an employer where you give up a percent of what you produce for almost the name. And an example I use, I mean, I studied finance in college, and if I wanted to go out and start my new firm right after school, you know, 20 years ago, it would have been very hard to market myself and make myself stand out. So what would I do? I'd go to Goldman Sachs. I'd go to JP Morgan. I'd find a boutique, well-known investment banking firm to go to. That's a way to show my quality and signal that. And in a way, I would take less income in order to, let's say, work at Deloitte. But now, when you can go out and start your own firm and rely on things like the internet, on things like peer-to-peer reviews, professional reviews, those types of standards, now it makes it much easier to work for yourself. It's the whole idea of these information asymmetries that existed before. Workers are able to overcome those in ways that let customers know their quality and service level without going to a large employer.
So on a more high level, would you say that sharing economy started when people organized this contracting out online? Or what about when you would put out ads in newspapers before internet existed? Was it the pre-sharing economy stage?
Yeah, I mean, all these business models that the sharing economy embodies, they're nothing new. What's happened is that the transaction costs have fallen so much that they become much more common. I would say really the rise of peer-to-peer online interaction, things like eBay in 1995, the growth of that, that's where you can trace the beginning of this growth in independent work to. And if you look at the graph showing the rise of 1099s filed with the IRS, it really does coincide with peer-to-peer interaction on the internet. Because I use an example of my mom. When I was growing up, she would go to the Goodwill and she'd make mittens out of old sweaters that she'd find and then sell them at craft stores or craft fairs. And I mean, if she wanted to support our family doing that, I mean, good luck. Maybe she'd make $100 every other weekend. So it's not a very good plan if she wanted to do it for full-time work. But now what could she do? She could hop on Etsy and reach theoretically anyone in the world and grow her business in ways that would have just been too costly and too time consuming before. Think an era of higher transaction cost, it was a hobby. In today's era of extremely low transaction cost, it could be a full-time job. That's the kind of small changes that lead to overall massive shifts in how the labor market's organized.
And we definitely do need those mittens in this northeast weather.
Yeah,
so.
I was saying, considering it's, 16 degrees when we're recording this?
Yes,
but
absolutely.
One more example on this is it's not just the Labor Department that's taken moves to realize the importance of independent work and where everything's going. You also have Representatives Diane Black and Elise Stefanik filing a bill called the Harmonization of Coverage Act, which would fix that problem I brought up where the Fair Labor Standards Act used a different test than everything else. For example, if you're a business owner and the government accuses you of misclassifying your workers, there's cases where a business owner has won against the IRS in court, but then lost to the Wage and Hour Division of the Labor Department because they're using different tests. So this bill kind of just takes a nice middle road and says, look, let's have one standard and use it across federal agencies so we have some stability, and it makes it a little clearer for job creators on how they can structure their organization.
Would this bill close that loophole that would let Department of Labor write a blog post that would regulate?
It would close it because it would mean that they'd all have to use the common law test, which is, as I said, is the most commonly accepted one. I think it's the strongest standard to use that makes the most sense because I when you're making decisions on if someone's an employee or an independent contractor, I don't think it should matter how economically dependent they are on the worker or on the company because that's so individual specific. What should matter is the degree of control, just like it was always intended to do, to understand how people are organized for working.
So what's the update on that bill? What stage is it at?
I still haven't seen a Senate counterpart, and I don't think they've had a hearing on it yet, but it's something that I think is looking forward is a smart move because we need to make sure that we don't bounce back and forth on administrators' interpretations just depending on who's in power. It is something that I think Congress needs to get involved in because the workforce has changed so dramatically over the last 50 to 80 years. I don't understand why we should be using the same laws from then to try to govern the independent workforce that we already have today and that we're only going to be increasingly moving towards.
On that note, I want to thank Jared Meyer, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Government Accountability, for showing us the pitfalls that can happen when executive branch overregulates or regulates via blog post. And thank you, Jared, for coming for your 22nd and final time on this show.
Yeah, Ash, I think you have more friends than Evan, so you'll have plenty more people you could bring on the show.
Absolutely. You can find Jared's work at Forbes and via his Twitter and at the Foundation for Government Accountability's website. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tech Freedom. Leave us a review on iTunes. Hopefully you reached your destination by now, and thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.